Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Well, welcome to the Talky Bit. I should say right off the top that there's an undercurrent in this Talky Bit, an ideological undercurrent. Maybe there always is, but this one is close enough to the surface, but still not explicit. I wanted to be explicit about it. And it's a belief that I hold that I know not everyone shares. I've mentioned it here before, but in this context, I'll unpack it a little bit. I believe that religions are something that we humans make. So I was careful with the sentence, I believe. It's a belief. That's a belief. That means it's disputable, all right? It's not a fact. Which means if I'm being reasonable and honest with myself, I should be able to be in meaningful dialogue with other folks whose beliefs about this, among other things, are different than mine. That's the nature of a belief. The critical matter in that process is often whether all the parties understand that they're talking about beliefs. Our beliefs matter to us. They're powerful and important. And it gets it's easy to blur the line between belief and fact. It's easy to treat beliefs like facts, as though they were independently true, regardless of what we believed about them ourselves. And so that's really an important signifier. With that in mind, out of those beliefs are some thoughts for me. I think that religions, like other components of culture, are powerful. I think they are meaningful. I think they're important. I don't find myself backing away internally or ideologically when I hear somebody talk about a belief that they have and say, when I found this belief, let me take it in sort of conservative Christian parlance, when I got saved, let's say, as a catchphrase for taking on a set of beliefs, it changed my life. Like, that's not hard for me to believe. I don't have to share the belief that that person encountered to believe, along with them, that it was life-changing. I also don't find myself taken aback when somebody says, there was a belief system in my life for a long time that almost destroyed me, or that really harmed people around me or harmed me, right? This is the nature of beliefs. And there's some reasons for that. I also don't believe that belief or that religion is the only legitimate framework for belief, or what we might call faith. And I don't believe that religions are permanent. I think the evidence for this, historical and in lived experience, is overwhelming. The simplest way that I know to test this idea, because this is a thing we should do with ideas, the simplest way I know to test the idea that we make religions is to ask the question, do religions change? And having had to acknowledge that they do, I don't know anybody who would deny that. Who's ever studied religion, for sure. So do religions change? Yes, they do. Then the subsequent question in that process for me is the question, who makes the changes? And just putting those two ideas side by side and examining the history of religion makes me go, we make these, and we change them. And I know this can be a thorny issue, perhaps most of all for those who regard themselves as true believers in any particular religion. That's who tends to be the most troubled by this line of thought. The alternative, in similarly simple terms, because I'm being pretty reductionist here with lots of big things, might be to say that a particular religion, or at least its central sacred text or texts, was given to humans by God and is consequently not open to being questioned. Not an unusual claim, and one made by many different religions. So saying that I'm going to leave it at that might sound any number of negative things. It might sound arrogant or simplistic or dismissive. I don't feel any of those things about this, but unless we really want to get into the weeds on this, and today at least that's not where I'm headed, I'm going to do just that. I'm going to leave this huge question at that,
with the acknowledgement that my personal take on this is always a work in progress. It doesn't come with any claims of unassailable objectivity. All right. I hope that choice doesn't make it too difficult to engage with the rest of this. And I hope that even for some of us, it's helpful. So with that in view, bit of a shift here. As a family, we have always enjoyed the out of doors. For over a decade, Corrine and I made our living in the world of camping programs for teens, and so summer was spent almost entirely outside, all day, every day. And then when summer was over, programmatically, and we needed to get away to recharge our own batteries, we went camping. And while we don't spend time outside at that same level of intensity or duration anymore, it's not our occupational space at this point, when we're given the choice, that's still where we go to replenish our spirits and sort of reinvigorate our bodies. Being active outside just seems to work for us on a bunch of levels. In my experience, being outdoors provides the opportunity to readily access some significant life lessons. And perhaps, this is speculative, but perhaps it's because being outside, especially, I would say, and I think this is significant, especially in self-propelled ways like hiking or cycling or paddling, those kinds of activities tend to strip away several of the ways that we otherwise normally insulate ourselves from some of the realities around us. Corrine and I had a recent brief conversation. It was brief because we agreed promptly about it, among other things, that we have just zero interest in going back to doing things outside that are recreational and motorized. Having spent many years in Corrine's life, especially skiing, water skiing, you know, around power boats, right? They're just like, should we get one of those? If we could, should we? Would we? It's like, nope, just no interest whatsoever. I think I'd get a real kick out of an hour on a jet ski, but I'm really not interested in owning one. It'd be sort of like, you know, recreational drug use or something. That was fun. We probably shouldn't do it all the time. I think those self-propelled things where we depend on our bodies, the most basic of which is walking, of course, and I know not everyone can do this, and not everyone can do it freely or in mixed terrain, so I understand that it's a privilege, not a given, but those, that as an example, historically even, of ways in which people have thought deeply while engaging their bodies, in the history of Western Eurocentric thought, pretty much all the big ideas have, at some point in their history, someone who went for long walks. It's kind of fascinating. Interesting intersection there. All right, so again, those things in view. 1967, a guy named Desmond Morris, he's an English zoologist, the curator of mammals at the London Zoological Society. He wrote a book titled The Naked Ape. Even if we don't know about the book, the phrase is probably in our heads. It clearly resonated. It promptly sold, like in a few months, it sold 500,000 copies. So there was an appetite for the ideas in there. The simplest idea of which, of course, is that we have shared ancestry with primates and we're just the ones with less hair. So hence naked apes. So whatever we might think of the idea of shared ancestry for us and primates in general, it seems to me that being outside sometimes gets us a little bit closer to encountering reality as naked apes, as physical beings less buffered, less bubbled by technology, less sheltered by the things that our big brains come up with to put some distance between us and that which we cannot control, between us and what we sometimes in this setting have called reality, what we might also call nature, or depending on our experience of the moment, we might just call the weather, right? You know, the stuff that's happening around us environmentally. So what I thought I would do today is a bit of an exercise in reflecting on both some of the experiences of this summer for me and of life in general. I wanted to consider a few ideas about why we make religions. I'll get to the connection, or if you prefer, systems of belief. And just a little sidebar here, systems of belief and religions overlap, but they're not the same thing. So religions are a system of belief, but you can have a system of belief that's not a religion. So, right, to just delineate, religious systems of belief have some signifiers that make them a unique subcategory of systems of belief, not least of which, by Western Christian definition, they include a deity, right? Anyway, so now we're into the debate about is Buddhism a religion, right? So anyway, so it's a little fuzzy on the edges and in transition, but there's a simple signifier between the two. So all to say that, I want to consider a few ideas about why we make religions or systems of belief that I feel like I've learned primarily from spending time outside. That's where they've become real to me. So the first is that I think we make religions because we need shelter. When you spend time outside, And I should expand that. I'm going to sort of focus on religions here, but I think we make systems of belief because we need shelter. When you spend time outside, especially if you do so in circumstances where retreat to something with permanent walls isn't an easily available option, you quickly learn that as a species, we're an interesting combination of durable and vulnerable. We can, generally speaking, endure a lot more than we think we can. We can learn to become more comfortable with being uncomfortable than most of us ever imagined. And we can keep on moving, like under our own steam, under rather difficult circumstances, much further than we might imagine, generally speaking. Unless we've had experiences where somebody or circumstances have pressed us into that space, and we've learned by experience that our capacity there is more than we tend to think it is. One of the experiences that Corinne and I have often remarked on happens when we reach some vantage point, typically in the mountains or where there's vertical terrain involved, from which we can see where we started. You know, where you kind of get to the summit and you can still see the parking lot for some reason. Something that happens not as often in the Rockies where there's an awful lot of trees, but in other terrain sometimes you can do that and you're just like, wow, we just came a really long ways under our own steam in the most basic way possible. We just walked and it just sort of felt like a lot of ordinary steps, and look where we are, you know. So that experience is an interesting one. On the other hand, so that's what, like, huh, right? This I'm going to say ordinary expenditure of energy and effort got us to this extraordinary experience. On the other hand, when we come to our limits as humans, our physical limits, our psychological limits, we can be in dire trouble pretty quickly. I don't know if you've ever had occasion to watch anybody slide into hypothermia. I have more than once, and often surrounded by people who, under the same circumstances, seem to be holding up just fine. And when you have an experience like that, you also realize that the point at which our need for shelter becomes undeniable and even endangers us varies considerably from person to person. When it comes to how this connects to why we make religions, I expect it's obvious that this is all one, you know, big old metaphor. It seems to me that one of the reasons we make religion is because we need ideological shelter. We need shelter from ideas or values or circumstances that threaten us or that we perceive as a threat. We might feel that we're coming to the end of ourselves, that if we don't do something, find something better than what we're presently experiencing, we're in trouble of the irreversible kind. We might feel as though we can't survive without some kind of sturdy framework, some kind of buffer between us and whatever it is that we feel assailed by. But we don't all come to that point at the same way or under the same circumstances or at the same point under varying circumstances, right? We might be vulnerable, if you will, to coming to that point much more quickly under certain circumstances than under others. And I would contend, although I couldn't defend it, I would contend that one of the reasons we are seeing such a marked, a noteworthy departure from organized religion in the Western world at this point in history is because many of the things that we felt like we needed shelter from are not things we need shelter from at this point in history. And also, on the other side of that same coin, that we're seeing a sort of snapback to certain fundamentalist, radical fundamentalist belief systems, because there are groups of people who do feel very threatened and for whom those frameworks really bolster a sense of identity and shared security or strength to resist the things that feel like a threat. So it varies. In my experience, when we're outdoors under difficult or demanding conditions, sometimes, and I'll illustrate this from a recent experience, sometimes our standards for what constitutes acceptable shelter can change considerably from our normal standards. And I'm not just talking about a tent is fine. Although that being inside a tent when it's raining can feel very smug. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but it's just like, somebody somewhere is wet right now, but it's not me because I'm in this tent and I can hear the rain, but it's not landing on my head, and that's a nice feeling, right? There's a saying of the weather in the Scottish Highlands where Corinne and I spent a couple of weeks this summer that you can have all four seasons in one day, and I would say that it is not hyperbole. On one hike in particular, we set out, and we knew the forecast wasn't great. It was, you know, all sorts of things were threatening, but this was the best day in the foreseeable days to do this particular hike, which was a longer, harder one. And we had the gear along that we anticipated needing if things went sideways. So we weren't especially concerned, even though this particular hike went high enough to take us over the course of the hike over five summits, five mountain peaks, or what the Scottish folks call Munros, which are peaks over a certain height. And you can bag Munros, right? You can buy a toque, in fact, that has all the Scottish Munros on it as X's. And when you get one, you just change the color of the X. And so people can just look at your toque and tell how many of the Scottish Munros you've got under your belt, if that's your thing. Anyway, so this one did five. And most of the elevation gain was at the beginning. So you kind of did all the climbing at the start. And then you kind of up and down your way around these five peaks and came back down. So we set out on this thing, and we were making some progress. And by the time we got to the first summit and topped out there, and we were hiking along this spine of a ridge to the next, and one of the reasons this hike is sort of famous is because you spend a lot of time on the ridges between peaks, and it just falls away on both sides. Like, it's very airy. You're just up there on these narrow ridges. It's spectacular, apparently. We couldn't see that. We could see the trail in front of us, and that was it. Because by the time we got to that elevation, the weather had closed in, and it got... I've spent a lot of time outside in inclement weather in the course of my life and my work. And I've been in wild summer storms. I've been in high elevation winter blizzards where you couldn't see the person that was 30 feet ahead of you on a climbing rope. I've been in some truly awful weather outside. And I can honestly tell you that this was some of the most unpleasant weather I've ever been in my life. Now, maybe just to put it in context, maybe that's like that old rock and roll adage, you know, like if it's too loud, you're too old. Maybe my 20-year-old self would have been like, bring it on, you know, right, or whatever. But fire hose rain that was horizontal, like incredible wind and rain together, dropping temperatures, fog that meant you really couldn't see where you were going at all. It got pretty grim. It was ugly enough, and the ridge was exposed enough and technical enough at that point that stopping to put on layers other than the most basic, you know, add rain gear now, was pretty hard to manage because if you had unlayered to layer up, everything you would have had on by the end of the process would have been completely saturated. So it just didn't, the thing that would have normally been the smart thing to do wasn't the smart thing to do. And in the end, it got dangerous enough that we decided to make our kids proud and also to not hand them their inheritance just yet, and we turned around and went back. On the way down, I came to a point where I made a very big adjustment to what I would consider adequate shelter. It was remarkable how few shelter options there were. Like, I mean, a big rock constitutes excellent shelter under circumstances like this. There just weren't any. It was just you were on the ridge and you were a naked ape out there. And so when we decided to descend, we were coming down a fairly long, steep, eroded section of trail, not unusual in that terrain as well, that there's lots of soft terrain, and so lots of the trails are deeply eroded. And in one of my hiking boots was coming undone because it was so saturated with water that it wouldn't stay laced up. It just laces were just squishing out, and they wouldn't stay tight. And I needed to stop and retie it to be safe, but my gloves were so soaked and my fingers were so numb that I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it with my gloves on because everything was too wet and clumsy. And if I take my gloves off in the wind, my fingers wouldn't work. So I was kind of a little bit rock in a hard place, so to speak. And in the end, I knew I had to do it. I had to deal with it to be safe because the terrain was really mixed. So in the end, what I did is I crouched down in an eroded section of trail. So the erosion was probably knee-deep at this point, right? That was my shelter. It was a knee-deep ditch that was this wide and like this. And it was adequate. Not normally what I would regard as adequate shelter. But out of the wind in that shelter, I was able to take off one glove, fumble my boot back tight enough. I couldn't get the glove all the way back on because it was too wet. So I kind of just looked like, you know, the day. It really looked weird. But it, you know, kept the core of my hand warm enough, right? And keep descending. Of course, as you descend, it gets warmer. And, you know, that's how you solve the problem, right? Under any other circumstances, that dent in the trail would have been, at best, an annoyance. Under those circumstances, it constituted shelter. I first sort of learned this principle as when I was spending time winter mountaineering, right? So an emergency bivouac when you're winter mountaineering, sometimes when it's really dire, you just dig a ditch in the snow. And if you've got a bivy sack, you put you in it and you go in there and you just pull the snow back, right? And it's not going to keep you warm, but it might keep you alive. And so how we think about what constitutes adequate shelter right? It changes in the circumstances. I'm trying to remember this experience when I encounter people who seem to believe in things that I find completely unbelievable. This doesn't tell the whole story, but it sometimes helps because it reminds me to ask questions like, what might their circumstances be? What duress are they under? What sense of threat? What do they need that this framework that might look to me like an ideological ditch, like a dent in the landscape, not real shelter, what do they need that this ideological ditch provides, even if only for a few metaphorical moments? What need does this meet? It just helps me think a bit different. Fires up the empathy engine a little bit. When we need shelter, sometimes what looks like an annoyance or an absurdity to someone else might look like just the haven that we need. This also helps me have a little more empathy for folks who struggle with broad category, with addiction, for example, right? Therapist who was on the other side of the conversation from me, so my therapist at one point said of a behavior of mine, what does it do for you, right? Pissed me right off. But they were right. You know? Yeah. Huh. That's a good question. So for myself, a good question. For my view of others and what they latch onto, it's a good question. So that's one part. Sometimes I think we make religions because we really don't want to face our finitude. We really don't want to face our temporariness. The Mary Oliver poem that I shared in the blurb last week, she interrupts this rap description of being fully attentive to a grasshopper, among other things. I don't know if any of you read it, but it's quite a charming and also quite a challenging poem. So she interrupts this description of what she's experiencing with this pair of lines. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? And she's commenting on her own attentiveness to the space she's in, to the flowers, the grasshopper, right? Her point is that sometimes, maybe always, although there's lots of things that seem to get in the way of this, sometimes the best thing we can do is, in Oliver's words, is just kneel down in the grass. Pay exquisite attention to what will surely pass too soon. Growing up as I did around the imagery of the Bible, which is full of imagery, what comes unbidden to mind, and so help me, in King James English, is this text. Consider the lilies of the fields, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. So there's the King James version. If you look it up in the Message, which is a thought-for-thought paraphrase, Eugene Peterson chooses to describe not their toiling or spinning, but the fact that they're never observed by humans, which is an interesting sort of anthropocentric interpretation of that text, which, if you care to look up the context, this particular quote is from the Gospel of Matthew. But intriguingly, the writer of that goes on to make the argument from this that if the divine pours this much attention and creativity into grass and wildflowers that no one's ever going to see, things that when we do see them, we might just mow down because they're in the way of something else we desire or think we need, then, if that's a given, then we should just relax because surely we must matter at least that much, and so we can anticipate being provided for. So that's the extended logic that flows out of that in its context in Matthew, right? And that sounds pretty lovely, doesn't it? It does, however, kind of skip past the part where the King James Version reminds us that the grass is here one day and the next day gets tossed into the oven, which is the sentence right before the bit that I read. So is it wondrous? Is Mary Oliver right? Should we just kneel down in the grass and attend with this, bring ourselves as fully to that moment of attention as we can? Because what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Shall we do that? And then when we do that, how does that speak to our knowledge that this could get mowed down and tossed into the oven, that it's temporary? Does that support that idea? Does it assail that idea? What if it does both? We're not so different from the grass, it seems to me. Both wondrous and temporary. But we're surrounded by a culture that is often fixated on this value of youth, of pushing away our temporal nature, on the advances that kind of reduce the limitations somehow or the vagaries of our dance with time. One of the things that spending time outside has reminded me of over and over is that we live one heartbeat away from those undeniable encounters with our limitations. I have, on at least one memorable occasion that I'm acutely conscious of, made safety errors that could have cost someone their life in one short step. Under the circumstances, those particular circumstances, it was just a thing to acknowledge and move on. It happened on a small ledge far above the ground, and the choices were limited. But decades later, I could take you on a hike and take you to that exact climb. This is not a vague memory at all. That moment still comes back to me whenever I encounter some circumstances that have unanswerable questions in them. It's a bit of a beacon experience for me. These past few weeks, we as in our family, Karine and I maybe most particularly, we've been dipping in and out of a kind of what I would describe for myself as a kind of diffuse grief about the fires in Jasper. I've mentioned this before in this space. But in this context, that's a place that we love. It's one that we spent a week in and around and just deeply embodied in June of this year. And watching it burn, seeing the pictures of the aftermath of that, has been and continues to be a challenging experience. One of the things that the survivors of that experience keep talking about, and one of the things that survivors of these kinds of world-altering experiences often reference, is the mystery of why did this house burn and the one next to it stay standing? Why is the whole block gone? And when you see the videos, you know, of any of these situations, you see this, right? It's like a whole neighborhood obliterated, and here's this one, like, looks like it got dropped into the set by a helicopter, perfectly intact house. It's an illusion, of course. That house might be physically intact, but it's damaged in all kinds of other ways. But it's standing, and the others aren't, right? For those whose home survived, when you hear them talk about it, survivor's guilt is often a challenge that they talk about. Why were we spared when they weren't? And we encounter similar dynamics, I think, whenever we're confronted with mystery, perhaps especially the mystery surrounding loss. I'm intrigued in the Jasper story. I'm intrigued and troubled by the uproar about who's to blame in that particular story. I mean, I know this sells. But it also feels like there's some important parts of the story that are being completely ignored. Where is the nature bats last part of this narrative? Where's the voices that remind us that we're all temporary, that there are profound limits to what taming the wilderness entails? Is it our hubris that keeps us from telling that part of the story? Is it our fear that keeps us from telling that part of the story? Is it denial that keeps us from telling that part of the story? Those are all negatives. Is it hope that keeps us from telling that part of the story? Open question. Voluntarily stripping away some of the insulation, choosing to move through wild spaces under my own steam, carrying what is deemed necessary at some points in my life, experimenting with what it feels like to reduce those resources by choice, to carry less, all remind me that there is nothing better to do, that there is, in fact, perhaps nothing more important than to kneel down in the grass, literally, metaphorically, practically, to attend as deeply as I am able to what is beautiful, what is good, what is mysterious, what is beyond my control. Some would say divine. We don't need to use that language, but we can. In contrast to that, I think that we sometimes make religions because, not always, but sometimes we make religions because they provide a narrative that we find more appealing than that. Or if not appealing, accessible, graspable than that. If life is temporary, and we're confronted with that, we become aware of that, as we tend to developmentally, we can tell ourselves a story about living forever. If life is sometimes hard, even impossible, we can include luxurious accommodations and needs met without efforts in the details of those stories. It's worth remembering that in terms of Christian belief about forever, that many of the images that we have were generated by people who were dispossessed, who were prisoners of war, who lived regularly with the trauma of having lost not just their land and their homes, but being taken over in a way that stripped them of identity, when identity was one of the things that kept you alive. Powerful forces, right? If we feel the need for a bit more control over the outcome of forever or the next round, we can make a story about how our choices now impact how we'll come back. One of my kids has been finding a fascinating stream of electives in the study of religion. Tyrion will, upon the completion of the final three courses this term, have a degree in jazz piano, with, if they choose their electives accordingly, a minor in religion, which amuses the heck out of everybody in the household. But just they've just been intrigued by and encountered some thoughtful people in their university life teaching about this stuff, and have, you know, piled up enough of those electives to have that minor. We were having a conversation the other day about reincarnation and some of his study about that, and about the cost of either heedlessly or willfully, and there's a distinction in that system of belief, killing anything that's alive, including bugs. If we want to influence the outcome of forever or the influence of the next round, we can include things in the story that are about that, right? We can believe certain things and engage because of that. And to be clear, I am not making light of any of this. I think we do these kinds of things. I think we make these stories and systems of belief because we are trying very hard to do a number of really important human things. We're trying very hard to figure out how to cope. We're trying very hard to figure out how to proceed and how not to proceed under the cloud of having no way to think about or anticipate what might come next. No way to exercise some control over this vast arena of challenge and mystery in our lived experience. We are trying the best ways we know how to connect with what is beyond us, for which we can use all kinds of different language, right? Including God language. It's a big deal for us as humans. If there's one thing that we can't seem to help ourselves about, it's trying to do this. Or just kind of closing it right off and operating in a system of belief that has zero room for it, for this. There's no room for mystery in there. Which is also a way of doing those same things, I would contend. This, it seems to me, is a legitimate and perennial human challenge. It is also the reason that the table exists, to provide a space where we can consider some of these things together in a, not always ideally, but not life-threatening, climate-controlled setting. If you're finding it too chilly in here, take that as an inconvenience rather than as, you know, I don't see anybody sliding for hypothermia here. James? Right? You know, so we can do this work without a pressing sense of imminent danger or threat together. At least that's the goal. That's the reason for being. To do that consciously. Being outside reminds me that it's not only a goal, but it's a privilege, and perhaps a fragile privilege. It's one, this exploration. It's one to hold tenderly. It's one to hold gratefully. And I would say, perhaps even with a kind of joyful surprise, that we get to do it at all. It's not a given. It's really not a given. If I needed to defend that notion, I won't do this now as an exercise, but I would just ask if there's anybody in this room that could tell me a story about having been part of a religious setting where the opportunity to explore without fear of negative repercussions was built into the fabric of that setting. And there would be some people whose lived experiences, I've been in a setting where that permission is not present. It's not a given, all to say. It's not a given. It's not magic. Sort of like breathing. It's a thing we have to do for ourselves, you know? We have to attend to it. Maybe as Mary Oliver reminded us last week, that opportunity can be a partial answer to the question that she poses, which is, tell me, what else should I have done? Peace.